Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. You can also support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. And finally, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. My name is Anders Halverson, and my guest today is Ernesto Flores. Ernesto is a wildlife and fisheries biologist for the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks. He received his undergraduate and master's degree from Fort Hays State University. And I'm not going to give too much more of a biography there, Ernesto, because I'd love to just chat with you about how you got into fisheries and hear about what you're up to now. So welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be here and talk all sorts of fisheries things. So just a little bit of background about myself. I am a Kansas resident. I grew up in Western Kansas in a town of about 1,000 people. I attended Fort Hays State University, which is about an hour away from Ness City, for my undergraduate degree. I graduated there and then also completed my master's degree there as well.
Okay, so tell us, how long have you been interested in fisheries and being a fisheries biologist?
Well, it started at a young age. So I was one of those kids that was always watching Animal Planet and Discovery Channel. I inhaled every sort of content that was out there. I watched the Jeff Corwin Experience. I watched Steve Irwin. Anything that was science related, I kind of always had in the back of my head. I was like, man, this stuff is really cool. So, and then I also liked to fish growing up. I didn't really have the opportunity to go out fishing, you know, all the time. I didn't have a boat. It was often just fishing with some old rod and reels and, you know, putting corn on a hook and catching carp. I didn't know at the time what I was really doing, but I knew the thrill of being able to catch something. I was like, man, this is awesome. So
that's kind of how to go fishing? Was it right nearby where you were growing up?
In Western Kansas, there's not much water, so you have to travel. But we were fortunate enough to have a lake by the name of Goodman State Fishing Lake, which is about 3 or 4 miles south of where I grew up. And that was just basically like a 50 to 60 acre lake. But it went dry quite a bit. It's just there's just not much water out there. So eventually it go dry periodically. But when there was water, we had the opportunity to go there and fish. And then I also fished a place called, the locals called it Broken Bridge. It was just basically a little stream where we did, we did catch a few largemouth bass there. That was a lot of fun. But that's basically where my love of a fishing developed.
And so then you go off to Fort Hays State for college, and you knew right from the beginning you were going to be a fisheries biologist?
No. I showed up on campus. I was like, man, what is this? What's college? And I had grandiose visions of, I think, becoming a PE teacher and becoming a head coach, coaching basketball. I really liked playing sports growing up. So I had this idea that I was going to be a PE teacher. I enrolled as I originally actually thought I was going to be a meteorologist. And then they told me that I had to take a bunch of math classes. And I was like, well, I'm out, man. I got to go somewhere else. So I was like, okay, I'll be a PE teacher. I enrolled in the Human Health and Performance Program at Fort Hays. And about a semester and a half in, I was like, man, I don't know if I can do this. I knew in the back of my mind, I was like, I've always loved biology. So I think I just woke up and I went and visited with the biology chair of Fort Hays State. And I was like, man, I really want to switch to biology. So he gave me a new advisor and I kind of enrolled in some preliminary science classes. And that's kind of how I find myself down the path.
What year are we at this point?
It was around 2013, I would say, if I had to estimate. So 2013.
Sounds good. So you get hooked on biology and you like fish, and how did you keep going?
So I found myself taking, at this point, I kind of had finished some gen eds. I enrolled in botany and zoology classes, both with labs. And I was getting beat around, man. I don't think I'd learned how to study yet. So I was like, man, this is tough, but it'll be worth it. I didn't really know that I wanted to do fish quite yet. I just knew I wanted to do biology of some sort. But I had a professor by the name of Dr. Farley. He was the zoology professor. He had actually quit teaching like my class. I took zoology, and then like the next year he had actually quit being a teacher. He had moved on to something else. So I was like one of his very last classes that he got to teach. Well, he was always kind of picking on me in class, like calling me out, making me answer questions. And I was like, wow, these professors, they care. And then he was always kind of stopping me in the hall and just being like, hey, how are you doing? How's class going? So we kind of started to develop a relationship there. But like I said, I still didn't really know. I kind of enrolled in all sorts of classes. I took parasitology, genetics, you know, just your basic bio courses. And then it wasn't until I took ichthyology, and I'm sure that's how it happens. I've listened to some of the podcasts beforehand, and I've listened to people's background. I'm like, man, I took ichthyology and that was it. I was hooked. That's really when the light bulb came on for me.
Why? I'm curious. Why fish? Why not plants?
Well, that is another story in itself. So my advisor for the very end of my undergraduate and then my master's degree, Dr. William Bill Stark, I knew right off the bat, I was like, man, this guy's, he's going to be a great teacher. He's going to be a great advisor. But I had enrolled in ichthyology. We had our very first lab exam. It was just a short 20-point question, just being able to identify different species of fish. And I wasn't really that great of a student. I mean, I was pretty average, but I took the class and I got like a 19 out of 20 on the first quiz. I tried. I legit studied. And he wrote on my quiz and said, I hope to see this the rest of the semester. And I was like, oh, man, he's putting the pressure on me now. So at that point in time, I was like, this is what I want to do. And as I got more involved in the class and started being able to identify fish and learn all about the biology, I knew that that's what I wanted to do.
So, and then you got involved in a particular project with him, right?
Yeah. So right after I took that class, there was an opening for a district fisheries biologist job. That was about 50 miles away from Fort Hays. The hire there was a former graduate student of Dr. Stark. He was a fisheries biologist, and he needed a tech position for him for the summer, since this was his first summer. So he naturally got a hold of Dr. Stark, and then Dr. Stark was like, well, I got a guy. And basically I met up with him in the office or in the halls of Albertson Hall on campus and was like, well, here's a potential job opportunity. And at that point I was working at home and making a lot of money in the summertime. I was making enough money to kind of sustain myself throughout the college school year.
Wow.
And I took a pay cut and was driving an hour and 50, 2 hours round trip to go work out at Wilson Lake with this new position, and it ended up working out for me. But that's basically how I started working for Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks as a seasonal. I think that was in 2015 when I started.
Okay.
From summer.
And what in particular were you working on?
Well, he was just a district fisheries biologist. It was basically any sort of fish duty that you could think of. I credit him a lot in kind of my development as a fisheries professional, because it was not necessarily where a relationship where it was, or a working relationship where he was just kind of telling me, how to do things. I was kind of along for the ride as he was learning how to be a fisheries biologist as well. So a lot of the stuff that we did, whether we were evaluating, certain populations in his lake using, whatever gear, I was just kind of there. And that allowed me to ask questions. And I asked questions a lot because I was naturally curious about the process, the mechanism. We were already learning in school the ins and out of the life history of fishes, basic biology stuff. And I was just along for the ride in any job duty. So we stocked fish, we sampled, we used electrofishing. I remember him taking me, within my very first week, we went to go sample Lakewood. It's a small little community lake in Salina, Kansas. And we were shocking up short nose gar, long nose gar, buffalo species, largemouth, bluegill. And I was really excited and was just, curious as to why we were seeing so many different species. And then come to find out that particular little community lake was susceptible to overflow from a creek nearby. So a lot of the species of fish that were in the river or in the little creek nearby often over drained into the pond. So that's why we were seeing such species diversity in the pond. But it entailed a variety of different job duties.
Okay, so what happened next?
Well, I worked with him for the next 4 summers. I had finished my undergraduate. So it was probably after year 1 or 2, I got my undergraduate degree in fisheries, and I knew that I wasn't ready. I needed more experience. I needed to learn more. So I went and visited with my advisor, Dr. Stark, and was like, hey, I'd really like to continue my education. And at that point, I'd been working with my boss at Wilson Lake. And I asked him if, it'd be okay if we could develop some sort of research project at his lake. And then kind of tie it in with the master's research project. And it ended up working out for me that that's what I ended up doing in year three and four of working with him out there as a fisheries tech.
And so tell me about your master's project, which I think is something that you're still, that's still a line of research that you're interested in.
Yeah. So at that point in time, he had started and he knew that he had blue catfish in his reservoir, but he had difficulty sampling them and getting a hold of fish and really understanding what was going on with the population. So at that point in time, we were limited in terms of our electrofishing vessel. We couldn't effectively sample the lake very well. And that was due to high connectivity. So the lake itself is super, it's very salty. And we just weren't able to effectively sample blue cats. At that point in time, we kind of knew that low frequency electrofishing was coming on. And that was the way to, if you were able to effectively sample your fishery, that was the way that you wanted to do it. Well, we couldn't. We had limitations with our electrofishing vessel, and the water was just not conducive enough for us to be able to sample fish. So we had that question, what was going on with blue cats? Well, in Kansas, blue cats are up and coming. They're a species where just in the last decade, they've jumped in terms of angler's preference. They really enjoy catching them. They enjoy eating them. So, you know, it was kind of a point of interest for us to figure out what was going on with that population.
What's driving that? Why are blue cats all of a sudden a very popular fish?
They present value, I think, to our constituent base here in Kansas. So blue cats have the potential to reach trophy lengths. We all know that there's, you know, 50, 60 pounders. There's, I think the record in Kansas is north of 100 pounds.
Wow. Wow.
Maybe. Don't come at me if I'm wrong. But they have the potential for getting up there in size. And then at the same time, they also are a very tasty fish. So we have a lot of our constituent base is driven by being able to catch fish and then being able to take them home and eat. Well, blue cats offer dual value in that, you know, they offer our trophy anglers an opportunity to catch a fish of a lifetime. And then they offer our consumptive anglers the opportunity to go catch fish, fillet them, and be able to have fish fries back at home. So they offer dual value.
Okay, so that makes sense to me. The only thing that doesn't make sense is why they haven't been a popular fish for 100 years.
Well, they were introduced into Kansas initially in the 70s, but they were just more, they were stocked, but they weren't really evaluated. It didn't really become a point of interest for the agency until 1990, where they were introduced into Milford Reservoir, which is a 16,000 acre reservoir nearby Manhattan, Kansas. That stocking, it didn't take hold. We didn't see signs of recruitment until I think 2001. So 11 years post introductory. And basically after we found out that they were recruiting there, then they started to become, then we started stocking them into other larger water bodies, you know, 3,000-4,000 acres in size or greater. And at that point, we started stocking them into other impoundments. And in terms of a blue catfish fishery, from what I've seen here in Kansas, like it takes some, you know, several decades to really establish and be able to take hold until you start seeing, you know, the signs of a fishery.
Okay, so you gave some sort of practical reasons for why blue cats are so popular now, but I think in one of our email correspondences, you also described it as a magnificent animal. I got the sense that you're really pretty in awe of these fish. Is that true?
Yeah. And I'm in awe of them because we don't really know much about them. There's just so much to learn. They act so different, almost fishery by fishery. So each impoundment, each lake offers different characteristics, different forages, you know, different bathymetries, just a plethora of different variables. And it seems like these blue cats, they act accordingly based on what's given to them. And some have the potential to grow these large fish, these trophy sized individuals, but others, you know, they may be geared towards producing a fishery where it's more designed for people to catch, not necessarily 50 and 60 pounders, but be able to catch 25, 26, 27 inch fish that are still great for people to eat. I mean, that's still a large fish.
Yeah, that's a big fish. I was laughing. I come from the trout world. That's a big fish.
Yeah, but so in that essence, it just, I'm in awe of them because they act so different. So they're a part of the catfish family. You know, we have channel cats and flatheads, and even them themselves, they act differently. Blue cats, they're a pelagic predator and these impoundments, to me, they seem like they school up and are just voracious. They're voracious predators. They just have a really cool life history. And each fishery that I've had the chance to look at, to sample, to look at growth, they all just behave extremely different. So it's more just because I'm inquisitive and really want to know more. And that's why I'm in awe in them. It's something that I definitely want to, I'm interested in learning more.
Now, you describe them as voracious predators. Is that ever a problem if you're trying to manage other species?
It can be. I know on the East Coast, I was just there for the American Fisheries Society's 151st conference, and I was actually visiting with several of the, I had a class there with several locals from that area, and I asked them whether blue cats, you know, what their perception was. Well, they're invasive in parts of the East Coast. So I know they can become a problem in Kansas. We don't really know yet. Like I said, they act kind of as a pelagic predator. We do have other pelagic species, a lot other pelagic fish that we manage, like walleye, a lot of muronid species. And we haven't really evaluated or haven't looked into the effects of whether they actually have a negative impact on other fisheries. They kind of just do their own thing.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they are, I think, a problem in Virginia and the Chesapeake in particular. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's more... if I remember right, they were having a negative impact on local fauna that was already established there. So they were introduced there and they aren't supposed to be there, but now they're having some negative impacts on local, I should say, I don't like throwing the word native, but native things that were already there.
Okay. So you're still working a lot on blue catfish. Sounds like an interesting study. And what else does your job entail these days?
So as mentioned before, I'm technically classified as a fisheries and wildlife biologist out of the Emporia Fish and Research Survey Office. But the beauty of my job is that I get the pleasure to really work in a variety of different fields. So within our office, we have a aquatic nuisance species coordinator. We have our research supervisor. We have a human dimension specialist. We have a statewide research biologist. And then we have another person hired in our office that kind of has the same equivalent job title as myself. So just within that broad range of duties there, we get tasked with kind of helping with certain projects that are going on in the state. So another part of my job is working with the Aquatic Nuisance Species Program.
So what species in particular are you worried about right now?
First and foremost, we're worried about zebra mussels. Mm-hmm. We do, in our office, we monitor our impoundments that are managed by Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks. We go out and collect water samples twice a year. Those samples are collected during peak water temperatures where, you know, veliger densities are deemed to be the highest. So that's around 80 degrees here in Kansas. So we head out in the months of June and throw plankton nets at high use areas. That usually translates to about like 160 lakes that we sample. And those lakes often have multiple boat ramps or multiple high use areas. So we travel to those lakes, we throw our plankton net, we collect water samples, put them in algae bottles. And then we actually don't do any of the looking at the samples ourselves. We send them to people who have a much more trained eye up in Montana. And then they give us results, whether, you know, our water bodies are non-infested or are infested. We just try to get ahead of the curve. We do this twice a year to try to make sure that, you know, if a water body does become infested and then we open it up to it's open to traffic, we hopefully can catch that early enough to where we can say this has zebra mussels and make the public aware that, you know, if you come to this lake, you're going to need to clean, drain and dry your boat before you go to another impoundment to try to kind of mitigate the spread of zebra mussels. So we have not used it for zebra mussels.
So how's the battle going?
Since I've started here, we've only had two impoundments that have been deemed positive. So we're in the 3 years that I've been in my current position, only two water bodies. I think before I had started, we were averaging about one water body a year. So we're just below where we were before I started. So we're averaging about one water body per year.
One additional water body per year.
Yeah, of an infested water body for zebra mussels, yes.
Okay. Any other interesting invasives?
We do battle with Phragmites. Phragmites is something that's kind of a hot topic. We have our aquatic nuisance species coordinator in office is a huge duck hunter, a huge bird hunter, actually. He's always out in the marsh around this time of year. Mm-hmm. And he started noticing the problem at the duck marshes where it was you know, the Phragmites is basically this reed grass that just grows, you know, 10, 15 foot high and can really encroach shoreline. So it limits shoreline access around any sort of water source. And that's something that we've kind of started to talk about and are trying to address here in the state of Kansas, because talking about shoreline access, we're in the fisheries field. We want people to be able to enjoy the outdoors from the shore. When you have a species of vegetation that can really take hold and grow and basically drown out any sort of shoreline access, it can become a problem. So that's something else that we've kind of been talking about and trying to address here in the state of Kansas.
Okay. Well, moving on. So you also told me that you are involved with a project called Vamos a Pescar. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So a nonprofit organization here in Emporia, Kansas, by the name of the Hispanic Leaders of Today and Tomorrow. They had been putting on fishing clinics with the help of various other organizations. Fishing's Future, a gentleman by the name of Phil Taunton's really big on fishing education. He actually has almost like an whole army of instructors that show up to these events and are able to teach the people there about, you know, bait types, lure types, poles, when to fish, just all sorts of fishing information. So this all started really when the state of Kansas decided to publish the hunting and fishing regs in Spanish. I had met with a lady in the public affairs team here in the state and with the organization, the Hispanic Leaders of Today and Tomorrow. We actually went out to dinner and I got a hold, you know, that's how I kind of got to meet them. Well, a year later, they were like, hey, can you help us out with these events? And I was like, well, sure, I'd love to. So within the last year, we put on three different fishing clinics. They were limited to about 50 families, but those 50 families were able to show up on that day. They were provided a spinning rod and a bait cast rod or a spin cast rod, provided lures, worms, and then basically they got to take advantage of, you know, all the instructors being there, teaching them everything about fishing. They had questions in terms of regulations, you know, where they can fish, what they can fish for, what they can keep. We were just basically there presenting all the information to, I would say the majority of them were non-speaking, non-English speaking people. So I was kind of there. I'm able to speak Spanish. So I was able to really communicate with them. And, you know, if they ever had questions, you know, regarding where they could fish, all that type of stuff, I was kind of there helping out, trying to explain the importance, I guess, of understanding rules and all that good stuff. So that's kind of how I got started working there. It's a really, really sweet program. I really enjoy being a part of that.
And so when did you start doing that? What year was that?
So that was this year. They had been doing it for about 3 years before I started. This was my first year. Our first fishing clinic was in May, and we had a fishing clinic in May where we basically just showed them the ins and outs of fishing. Our second fishing clinic was in, I believe, August, and that was kind of more some like boater safety stuff. We let a lot of them get out on kayaks. We told them that they had to wear life jackets, you know, just basic regulations. And then the third fishing clinic was in September. Where they were able to use all of their gear. We provided worms. We even had a cookout for them. And it was just a good time. And we couldn't have asked for better weather on those three events. You know, you're always usually worried about wind or rain or something. It was like the picture perfect day, at least in September, when we were out there fishing. I mean, the cool thing is we were able to stock some fish into the pond where they were fishing beforehand. So we knew that they were going to catch something.
So is this a growing population or a population that traditionally has not been fishing as much that you are trying to reach? Is it, you know, I know that fish and game agencies are always trying to get new people interested in fishing. Do you think this is a model for other states?
Well, I'm not really sure in terms of other states, you know, what's being done. I think maybe Texas is kind of, I think they're pretty good at, you know, we call it R3, the R3 movement. But in the state of Kansas, I would say that
What's R3?
It's a recruitment, reactivation, and retention. So it's a big movement in the natural resource field where basically we're trying to implement those three different processes and try to, you know, retain our anglers, recruit new anglers, and then reactivate old anglers that, you know, may have, you know, said, I don't really want to fish, but it's something that they had done beforehand and, you know, we're trying to reactivate them. But I would say in Kansas that they've always fished. I would say, at least for Hispanic constituents, they've always fished, but they may not necessarily have had the information provided to them or, you know, are unable to grasp regulations, that sort of stuff. So I would say they've always been fishing, but now it's really great to see that we as a state are kind of progressing in a direction to where we're providing the resources for them to be able to understand what you need in order to be able to go in and take in the outdoors.
Sounds neat. So that means that it's time for the hard part of the interview, which is the last five questions that we ask of every guest that comes on the show. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, number one, what is your favorite fish?
Man, I have one that pops up right in my head, and I just give a big old spiel about how I love blue cats and how they're so awesome. I started out being a bass angler, so I love smallmouth. I think smallmouth are the meanest, most aggressive. I mean, they don't want nothing to do with you once you hook them. So I'm going to give two answers and say that I love researching. I love looking into blue catfish, but I love catching smallmouth.
Okay. What's your favorite memory from your career so far?
I would say my favorite memory, one thing that sticks out to me is, so I had just interviewed for my job that I have right now, and I was out at Milford Reservoir. We talked about it being a kind of a blue catfish, you know, trophy fishery. We were out there throwing jug lines, float lines, I should say. And basically we had a weight with a float, and we were fishing like a 10-knot circle hook baited with some common carp. Mm-hmm. We lost the float line. So we had GPS the float line on our depth finder, and, you know, we found every single one besides this one. This one was gone, MIA, done. So we're driving back to the boat ramp, and then we see this big giant orange wood bullet float moving. And we're driving over there, and as we get closer, that thing just takes off again. It goes underneath the water. And we eventually got a hold of it. We pulled it up, and I think it was almost like a 50-pound blue cat that we had caught. Just a massive, massive fish. And I think that's the largest blue cat that I have ever seen personally. And it took, you know, when you're taking a picture of it, we had two people. We had one person holding the very back end of the fish, and then the other person holding the front, because it was that big. So that's something that kind of sticks out. And that's, I mean, with any memory, it's kind of what you see as a biologist. You get to go out there and sample and see all sorts of cool stuff. A thing that sticks out is I was working with a fellow fisheries biologist, and he said, man, you know, in this job, you handle more fish in one day, fish of a lifetime, than most anglers do their entire life. So that's something that really stuck out with
me. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, what is your dream job or location?
My dream job would be to, I think I'm shooting to eventually do some sort of full-time research biologist job. It doesn't really matter. State agency for state or federal level, private. But just being able to evaluate fisheries kind of just be able to sample, look at the data, and then make, you know, inferences on what's going on with that particular fishery. I get to do that in my job right now. So I guess I kind of have what I'm looking for. In terms of location, I dream of that picture perfect. I love Kansas, don't get me wrong, but I dream of that picture perfect location where you're just looking out your back door, you see mountains, you're within, you know, a short drive of being able to hike and, you know, take in. I really love the mountains. So eventually I'm going to hopefully try to make my way down there or up there.
Colorado's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Colorado would be pretty sweet.
Okay. If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I would look at everything that I could in terms of blue catfish. I would look at entrainment. I'd tag fish. I'd set up receivers on them. I'd track their movements. I'd, you know, look at evaluating stockings. I would outfit myself with a electrofishing vessel with cup holders. I mean, the works, everything. I'd get new gear, you know, all that type of stuff. That's basically what I would dedicate the rest of my career to doing if money were not an issue, because that, I think there's just truly so much more that we don't understand and that we need to know regarding the blue catfish.
I think the best part of your answer was that you wanted a boat with cup holders.
I saw on Twitter, somebody mentioned that they just got a new boat with cup holders. And I was like, man, that's really cool. Just because you don't understand the struggle of having, you know, you got X amount of water on the boat. And then when you have a catastrophe, you hit a wave and your water source, just, you're done. You know, you need that stationary cup holder.
All right. Finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Working here in the office, I would say something that really sticks out to me. I've had the pleasure of working with a lot of great people here in my office. And one thing that sticks out is, I would say, standard random sampling. In the fisheries field, that's something that I think is very important. It was taught to me that this makes, you know, it allows you to draw comparisons from one fishery to another if the sampling design stays the same. So that's something that I myself truly value when I get to go sample fish, whether it's electrofishing or using gill nets, trap nets, whatever your gear you're using, be able to standardize it, being able to random sample. All that allows you to basically take the data that you got and compare it to other fisheries, other locations. And that's something that's really, really, really important to me.
I like it. Okay. Well, Ernesto, thank you for coming on the podcast today. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Well, you can reach me. I'm on Twitter. My hashtag is fishflores3. Email, you can reach me at ernesto.flores@ks.gov. I also would like to throw a tidbit before we close that we are going to be hiring two tech positions starting in June. And you can find that information by going to our website at KDWPT. You can Google search. This is kind of the easiest way, just KDWP jobs. And then you find our temporary positions and find the Emporia Fisheries and ANS tech position announcement. And you can submit your application information to myself. But I'm looking forward to hopefully having a really good recruiting class, like college football, you know, for this next year.
Are those seasonal jobs?
They are temporary tech positions. They're a maximum of 999 hours, which is an equivalent to about a 6-month term. But I'm looking to hire two positions starting in June. And you'll get a broad range of experience and you'll get to work with a bunch of really great people, including myself. So
best reason of all. And do they get to work with blue catfish?
Yeah. We actually have a lot planned for next summer. And it's something that we've been doing every year. We've actually have tagged upwards of like 2,000 blue cats a year in three different reservoirs that were greater than like 3,000-4,000 acres. And basically we're trying to learn all we can about blue catfish in Kansas. So there will be opportunity to do some low frequency electrofishing and do some age and growth, take hard structures. There's going to be a lot of opportunities. And then not only just that, we also are very involved with the Aquatic Nuisance Species Program for the state too. So you get just a broad range of experience and get the opportunity to work with new people. I know it's Kansas, but Kansas is awesome.
Okay. Come work. Sounds great. Okay. Well, thank you again, Ernesto. We really appreciate having you on. If you'd like to get a hold of me, again, my name is Anders Halverson, and you can find us, you can find me through the Fisheries Pod on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram at Fisheries Pod. Or you can send an old-fashioned email to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com, or you can find me at anders@andershalverson.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or you can buy Fisheries Podcast logo, shirts, hoodies, and stickers on Teespring. Again, I'm Anders Halverson, and my guest has been Ernesto Flores. Thank you for listening to episode 152 of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, standardized random sampling allows comparison across different studies and is crucial for research.